Well, I think I was on 15, right? Okay. We've already looked at mitochondria. Now we're looking at a chloroplast. And these are both examples, remember, of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. You can see multiple membranes here in this chloroplast in slide 15. There's, you can consider it really two or three, depending on how you define a membrane. But there's an outer membrane, an inner membrane just inside that, and then what is called a thylakoid membrane, which is all the green surface area. But really, the thylakoid membrane is continuous with the inner membrane. So whether you define it as two or three, it's kind of a word game. But just like a mitochondrion, since it has more than one membrane, is compartmentalized, so is a chloroplast. So there's an intermembrane space between the inner and the outer membranes. There is fluid that's inside the inner membrane but outside of these green sacs, and that's called the stroma. And then there's all the fluid that's inside the sacs. And by the way, what look like individual little coin-like sacs are not separate from each other. As you see in the cutaway view, all of that space is continuous. And that's called the thylakoid space because these little coin-like sacs individually are called thylakoids. Now, they occur in stacks. One stack of thylakoids is called a granum. That's a singular, but there are several grana, which is the plural, within one chloroplast. And what is the function of overall of the chloroplast? What happens there?
Photosynthesis.
So you see this only in photosynthetic eukaryotes. We don't have any of these because we can't perform photosynthesis. But plants and certain protists can. A protist, by the way, is kind of an informal grouping. A protist is any eukaryote that's not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. And some of those protists are photosynthetic, so they would have chloroplasts as well. 16 is next, and this isn't really any new information. It just gives you a real photomicrograph, it's not a cartoon in other words, of the elaborate membrane system that makes up the thylakoids in a chloroplast, in a real chloroplast. But we've already talked about all those structures already. 17 shows you some of the cytoskeleton that we talked about in the catch-all picture last time. And the cytoskeleton is made up of a system of three categories of proteins that I mentioned before, which were microtubules, microfilaments, and intermediate filaments. Two of those are labeled here, not all three. But all three of them are part overall of the cytoskeleton. And the microtubules in cartoon form are shown in yellow here. Those are what are growing from the microtubule organizing center that I was talking about last time, which is the centrosome. And in an animal cell, that centrosome will contain this T-shaped pair of centrioles, but you don't see those centrioles in a plant cell or other non-animal eukaryotes, although they still have a centrosome. And as we'll talk about later, there's times in the cell cycle when there are two centrosomes, two microtubule organizing centers. But the picture on the right just shows you that microtubules have a much bigger diameter than microfilaments. Let's take a closer look at, well, actually, there's this first. We'll have another picture of the cytoskeletal elements in a minute. But first, let's go to 18 and look just at microtubules. In cartoon form above, it's easier to look at what's happening here. Microtubules get their name because they are not solid rods, they are hollow tubes. But that tube-like structure is made out of many individual monomers that get hooked together in a spiral that makes it tube-like. And microtubules are important for cell division, as we'll talk about in a different chapter. And I already mentioned that a little bit. But they're also, as far as the cytoskeleton is concerned, microtubules are also important as little roadways, more or less, within the cell. Meaning that things can be moved along microtubules from one place in the cell to another. You see that happening in cartoon form on the top. This involves multiple proteins because, keep in mind, the microtubules are themselves proteins. But they're the road in yellow. And then walking along the road is a motor protein, so that's a different kind of protein. And that motor protein is carrying a cargo, a vesicle of some, having some contents, could be just about anything, that is being moved along that road, one step at a time. And each step requires expenditure of energy in the form of ATP. So it shouldn't be surprising that it's expensive to move things around in a cell. It doesn't happen for free. But that's more than, the cartoon is drawn that way, not just as a cutesy cartoon. They're actually shaped like this. You can see on the bottom a real photomicrograph of a microtubule and two-legged motor protein moving along. Now we can get to 19, where I said we would compare the three cytoskeletal elements, so all three of these different kinds of protein categories that I've already mentioned. Microtubules are the largest diameter ones. Microfilaments are the narrowest, the thinnest diameter, in other words. And therefore, the ones that are somewhere in between were called intermediate filaments for that reason. They're not as wide as microtubules, not as thin as microfilaments. But aside from the difference in their relative sizes, they have different functions as part of the cytoskeleton. Microtubules, I just told you, are important as roadways, but they're also important in cell division, mitosis and meiosis, that we'll study in a different unit, or with the details we will, at least. Microfilaments are really important in keeping the shape of the cell, whatever it is at the moment, which can change. It also allows for changes in the shape of a cell. And probably the most dramatic example of that is that microfilaments of different types are what cause your muscles to contract, which is a drastic change in the shape of the cell. The only thing muscles can do on their own is to pull. No muscle can push, because muscles get shorter actively. And they do that because actin and myosin, which are two kinds of microfilaments within the muscle cells, increase the overlap between them. So the filaments don't get shorter, but the overlap between them do, and therefore the entire cell gets shorter. And that's happening in all of the cells within a whole muscle, which is millions of cells big, at the same time. So when they all get shorter, the whole muscle gets shorter, and it therefore pulls on the tendon that it's connected to, which then pulls on the bone that it's connected to, and that's what moves your body around. Intermediate filaments are not exactly packing material, but they're structural elements. They're there for strength. They're important to shape as well, to a certain extent, but they're not involved in active movement. They're more of an anchorage device, like ropes, more or less. Okay, 20. Well, I was just talking about the centrioles that animal cells have, but plant cells, for instance, don't. And last time I told you that we don't really know what they do. Now, since the centrosome, which is what contains the centriole in an animal cell, is involved in cell division, you might think, well, the centrioles must have to do with something to do with cell division. But there's two problems with that assumption. One is that plant cells also undergo mitosis and meiosis, the same way animal cells do, and they don't have any centrioles. They somehow get away with it. And also, you can actually experimentally remove an animal cell's centrioles. If you do it carefully enough, they still go through with meiosis and mitosis as well. So, yes, it's reasonable to assume that they're there for some reason. We just haven't figured it out yet. Anyway, the centrioles are not the microtubule organizing center. The yellow haziness is what the centrosome is. The centrosome is the microtubule organizing center. So that's the place in the cell where these microtubules of various lengths grow from to produce that cytoskeleton. Here we're looking at two kinds of cell processes. Now, in this use of the word process, that means something that processes. To process means to stick out from. So I'm not talking about a system of things that are happening, a process that way. A cell process is something that sticks out from the surface of the cell. And there are different kinds. For instance, we looked at fimbriae before, I think, in a different slide. But these are flagella and cilia, which are both locomotory devices, meaning they both are there for the purpose of moving the cell. And they operate similarly in that they both push, when they move, on the fluid surroundings that the cell lives in. The big difference that you can see is how big they are. A flagellum is much longer than a cilium. Those are singular words. Also, no cell has to have either of these. Only some cells are flagellated or ciliated. But if a cell is flagellated, like a human sperm that we talked about before, then usually you will find a small number, one or a small number of flagella at just one end of the cell, just like in a human sperm. Whereas if a cell is ciliated, you will typically find cilia all over the surface of the cell, not just at one end, and there's going to be a lot of cilia. Cilia, by the way, means hairs. They're not truly hairs, but they look like hairs by comparison to mammals' hairs. And both of them push on the medium, as I said, so they can both move a cell around. But a flagellum is a propeller, and when it moves, it works just like a propeller in a boat. It pushes on the water and therefore moves the cell from point A to point B through the medium. A cilium can do that, or a group of cilia on a ciliated cell can also move a cell from point A to point B, in other words, move the cell through the medium. They kind of just tumble through the medium as the various cilia move back and forth. But that's true if the cell is free living, if it's a cell on its own, in other words. It's also possible, though, for a cell that is ciliated to be part of a multicellular organism. A good example in your body is that the epithelial cells that make up the inner lining of your trachea, your windpipe, are ciliated, but they are not free living cells. They are hooked together as part of the tissue. They're held in place, in other words. And so therefore the cilia moving back and forth is not for the purpose of moving the cell through the medium. Instead, it's moving the medium past the cell. And the medium is a layer of mucus. So these cells lining your windpipe are not only ciliated, they're also mucus cells, meaning they produce mucus. And mucus is sticky stuff. So that when you inhale, as you have to throughout the day, you're bringing in all kinds of debris, which is just not only debris that could build up and cause problems, but some of it is actually living pathogens that can harm you. So those things stick to the mucus pretty easily, whereas you don't want those to go deep into the lungs. Because inside of the lungs is very delicate stuff. So all the debris sticks to the mucus, but then since the cilia are continuously beating back and forth, that layer of mucus gets swept gradually upward to your throat, and as you swallow throughout the day, which you do unconsciously mostly, you are swallowing bits of mucus with a bunch of debris in it and putting it into your stomach, which is the perfect place to put it because that is the most inhospitable place on your body. It's the hardest place for living things that could hurt you to survive because of the high acidity, very low pH in your stomach. If we look at a detailed view in 22 of a cilium, we can see that a single cilium, of which there are many on one ciliated cell, is actually mostly a complex of proteins, including microtubules, just like the ones I've already talked about, but specialized for this, for a cilium. So the yellow microtubules are proteins, and the red things are just like the motor proteins I showed you. And they walk along microtubules just like they do when they're carrying things from one place in the cell to another. But in this case, the motor proteins in red, instead of having a vesicle for one motor protein as its cargo that's moving more or less in one non-round trip, one-way movement, instead, this team of motor proteins is attached to a microtubule, and then they're all walking along another microtubule beside it. If you imagine that being the only thing that were in place, then when they would walk, that just means the microtubules would slip past each other, right? Well, that wouldn't bend the cilium. And so there's still a third kind of protein involved, which are the blue ones. And those hook together the microtubules kind of loosely, so that when they do try to slip past each other because of the motor proteins, the connection between them prevents them from slipping further. You can illustrate that with a piece of paper. If you fold the piece of paper, the two sides of the paper represent two adjacent microtubules. And if they were not hooked together, two pieces of paper would just slip past each other. But if they are hooked together, like at the fold, then when you try to slip them past each other, it bends instead of slipping past. And that's how a cilium has this active sweeping motion. It takes a lot of energy. You have to expend energy for all these motor proteins to do that. But that's what's happening. And we see that in 23. This is what I just showed you, represented by the pieces of paper. That since the microtubules are anchored by that third kind of protein, the blue ones, when the motor proteins walk, they actually bend it instead. Well, here we see several different microvilli. And remember when I spoke about this the first time, when we were looking at the catch-all picture of the animal cell, when I compared it to a beach that you're walking along, microvilli drastically increase the surface area of the plasma membrane without actually adding much volume. So for things that require a bunch of surface area, like absorption, getting things from the gut, that you'll find a lot of microvilli. And you can see in this micrograph, it's a real picture, that microvilli are not just loose, empty, bag-like pieces of membrane. They have an internal structure made of microfilaments, another cytoskeletal element, to give them integrity, to keep them in that shape, in other words. Close-up on the top of the mechanism by which I explained skeletal muscles working. A single skeletal muscle cell, microscopically small, is made up of an end-to-end arrangement of these things shown on top, which are called sarcomeres, that include various proteins, but Most important are the two kinds of microfilaments involved, which are actin and myosin. And so one muscle cell, which is for cell standard very long, even though it's microscopically invisible small, I mean invisibly small, it's still much longer than it is wide. And a whole muscle is made up of many of these cells, many of these cells side by side, but a single cell, muscle cell, is as long as the muscle is. For instance, biceps brachii, you have cells that are so long that they go the whole length of that muscle. The muscle, though, is many cells side by side. Each cell, though, is a bunch of end-to-end arrangements of sarcomeres. And this is just one sarcomere shown here with two boundaries. And each of those sarcomeres is like a kind of like a train of a, I mean, a car of a train, end-to-end arrangement for a long span, a lot of numbers, a high number of cars in the train. But because the microfilaments increase their overlap, that means the boundaries of the sarcomere, which are represented by my thumbs, get close to each other. Without actually, the filaments aren't getting shorter, they're just overlapping more, and they're therefore dragging the walls of the boundaries of the sarcomeres closer together. And that's happening in all the cars of the train at once. The train is one long cell, but if you imagine that each train car immediately getting much shorter, the overall train gets way more shorter, and that's what pulls the muscle. And the same thing's happening on all the other cells that are in parallel with it, side by side in the whole muscle. So that involves microfilaments, but we also can have what's called cytoplasmic streaming, which can move things around within the cell. This is on the bottom. For instance, one use of cytoplasmic streaming is called cyclosis, which you can examine in a plant cell, a living plant cell. You might even see it downstairs in the lab if we look at plant cells that are living, because you're using a light microscope, so the plant is trying to arrange its chloroplasts so that they're facing the light, since chloroplasts use the light for photosynthesis. And they do that by interactions between microfilaments, and you can actually witness it as chloroplasts moving around in real time. And similarly, in certain unicellular eukaryotes, there is what's called amoeboid movement. An amoeba is not a species. There are a lot of things that we call amoebae. But an amoeba is something that doesn't have a definite shape. At any given moment, it's some shape, but the shape is always changing because of microfilaments interacting in between. And so they push out a piece of the cell, acting as a pseudopodium, a false foot is what it means, stick onto a surface, and then drag everything behind it, and then keep doing that over and over to walk around, basically. Okay, 26. I mentioned in the last lecture that there are little tunnels between two adjacent plant cells going through the cell wall that's between the two cells, and those are called plasmodesmata, those little tunnels. Plasmodesma is one of them, the singular. And you're just seeing a better view here, but there's no new information. I already told you that plasmodesmata are ways for plant cells to communicate with each other by allowing certain things to pass through those tunnels. And also, because of plasmodesmata, even though a plant is made up of trillions or many quadrillions, in the case of big plants, of cells, they all really share one cytoplasm, because the cytoplasm extends through these plasmodesmata from one cell to the next.
Is that what water binds to when it climbs up the plant?
No, that is done in specialized straw-like vessels called xylem that are living cells that make up the walls at first, but then the cells die, and it leaves just a thick straw made out of mostly cellulose from when they were alive. They die, though, so that it becomes hollow. There's no more cell stuff in the interior, and therefore water can go up it just by capillary attraction because of the polarity, as I talked about in the other chapter. All right, 27. Here we can see another use of the cytoskeleton. This is just a little piece of the plasma membrane, so this cell would be bigger than this room if we were looking at it, the whole thing. And there's, of course, the stuff that's inside the cell, the intracellular material on the bottom with the kind of orangish background. But all this stuff is on top in blue is the extracellular fluid and the extracellular matrix. The fluid is just the liquid component of it. The matrix is all the solid stuff that's embedded in it, a lot of which is proteins of various sorts. Well, how did these proteins get there? Where do extracellular proteins come from? They come from cells. Cells produce all proteins because the cell has to, because the amino acids that make up a protein as a polymer need to be hooked together under the direction of the cell, the ribosome, the mRNA. Those are all involved in building the protein. Well, some of the proteins stay in the cell because a lot of them function inside the cell. But if you have proteins outside of the cell, it's because a cell manufactured them and then exported them to that extracellular matrix. Anyway, here we have a use of the site of proteins in general for more or less strain relief. So there are proteins in the extracellular matrix, these rope-like blue things. There are proteins that they are connected to, these purplish globs that are part of the membrane. They're labeled as integrins here. Okay, now, if something pulls on these extracellular proteins, since they are connected to the proteins that are embedded in the membrane, you can imagine that that would just rip them out of the membrane pretty easily. But those membrane-bound proteins are at the other side, at the interior side of the protein, connected to still other proteins that are part of the cytoskeleton. The orange rope-like intermediate filaments that we see down here, or microfilaments, could be either, are accepting a force. If something tugs on it from the outside, it's going to tug on this instead of just ripping the plasma membrane, which is a pretty comparatively flimsy device. So that's why I say it's acting as strain relief. Well, this is also really no new information. It's just showing you that plasmodesmata are not just cartoons. This is a real picture of real tunnels between, or through the cell wall between two adjacent plant cells. But no new information. That brings us to 29. Well, plasmodesmata that we've looked at a couple times already are examples for plants. They're examples of intercellular junctions, which simply means something that joins two cells between the cells. Plants are not the only cells that have intercellular junctions, though. Animals have them as well, but they're not called plasmodesmata. And there are multiple different kinds of animal intracellular junctions that we're looking at here that you should know for this course. So first of all, acquaint yourself to what we're looking at. This is one animal cell that we're looking at the interior of. So it's been cut away, but in reality it would wrap around. This, we're just looking at the inside of one cell and part of the inside of two adjacent cells, one on either side of it. The first one I'll talk about is a desmosome, and there are multiple desmosomes shown here, but these three are desmosomes. Desmosomes are complex. All of these intracellular junctions are made up of proteins, just like plasmodesmata for plants are. Intracellular junctions in general are complexes of proteins, and that goes for desmosomes as well. But a desmosome is a pretty high concentration of proteins, meaning they're put into one place so that they can be particularly strong, and they extend through the thickness of one cell into another cell, the adjacent cell next to it. These desmosomes function more or less like spot welds. I don't know whether you know what I'm talking about on a spot weld. There's different kinds of welding that you can join metal with. You can have a long bead that holds things together along a long distance. But most car bodies are really just flat pieces of metal to begin with, which are shaped and then just connected at little spots here and there. And that's what holds them together and maintains their shape. That's what these desmosomes are functioning as in animal tissues. A tissue is a collection of cells. So desmosomes are not for one cell. They're about holding one cell to another cell. And therefore, since all of the cells in the overall tissue have desmosomes, it holds the tissue together. Keeps them from being ripped apart, in other words. Now, there is not shown here, but you can kind of imagine it, another thing called a hemidesmosome. Hemi means half. A hemidesmosome would be down here on the bottom, basically the same shape, and it's also a complex of proteins, but instead of holding cells together, it would hold this cell to the membrane it's lying on. So it holds it to the floor, basically. And desmosomes hold the cells in that layer to each other. The next category, though, are gap junctions, which you can see in the picture. And the gap junctions are really the animal version of plasmodesmata, because they are little tunnels between animal cells, just like plasmodesmata are little tunnels between plant cells. And they therefore function the same way. In other words, they allow for intercellular communication, because things can pass through those gap junctions. Probably the best example in your body would be connections between cardiac myocytes, which are muscles of the heart. Muscle cells of the heart, I mean. Cells of the muscle of the heart are called myocytes. And where they butt up next to each other, they are joined by gap junctions, proteins that act as tunnels, and that allows for the flow of ions. And that's important because ions carry charge, right? They're charged particles, and it's that change in charge distribution, which is a voltage, that causes the contraction of the heart muscle. Well, because these gap junctions exist, when contraction starts in one part of the atrium, what the top chamber of the heart, that contraction, that electrical impulse travels quickly from one cell to another, and therefore there isn't much time delay between the first cell and the last cell of that same chamber contracting. It makes all the cells of the chamber contract more or less simultaneously, which is important for being a pump, because then the whole thing squeezes and pushes the blood from the atrium to the ventricle, and then the same thing happens in the ventricle cells, because of these gap junctions. And then the other major category of intracellular junctions in animals is the tight junction that we see an example of here. Now, keep in mind, this is only half of the cell you're looking at, so the tight junction would be kind of like a band of tape going all the way around the circumference of the cell. And if you use the tape analogy, it's best to think of double-sided tape, because a tight junction sticks to all the cells around it, and it also sticks to the cell that has it. So tight junctions do add a little bit of stability, just like desmosomes do, but that's actually not the major function of tight junctions. They just have that as a bonus, basically. The reason that tight junctions are there, and the reason that they have to go all the way around, whereas desmosomes don't, is that they are trying to block passage of things between cells. So I have to say here that up to now, whenever I've been using the word membrane in these lectures, I've been talking about a subcellular structure, something smaller than the cell, whether it's the plasma membrane or the membrane of any of the membrane-bounded organelles we're talking about. All of that stuff is made out of molecules, right? It's much smaller than a cell. But we can also use the word membrane to refer to something that is many cells big. Like your skin, for example, is a membrane. That's a macroscopic membrane, though, as opposed to microscopic membranes that we've been talking about up to now. Well, if you have a macroscopic membrane made up of many cells, and I'll just draw a couple layers here to make the point, that is a barrier of sorts, just like your skin is a barrier, keeping you alive. If you are some sort of particle or organism trying to get through that macroscopic membrane, then there are two categories of ways you can do this. You could enter one of the cells of the macroscopic membrane, go through that cell, exit the other end, and then enter the next cell in the next layer, and so on until you're all the way through. Since you're entering cells to do that, that would be called the cellular route. The other major kind of possibility, though, is to not enter any of the cells of the macroscopic membrane, but instead just go into the spaces between the cells until you're all the way through. And that's called the paracellular route. Para means next to, like paralegal, for instance. Okay, so either one of these ways could get you through the overall tissue or the macroscopic membrane. But if this multicellular membrane happens to have tight junctions, look at this edge view right here, where it basically sews together these two adjacent cells, then the tight junction blocks the paracellular route. So you can see this with the red arrow. This thing could get all the way down to the tight junction, but then it runs into a dead end. And so tight junctions force things to go through the cellular route in order to get through, and the cells themselves can control, to some extent, what things can enter the cell and not, and therefore the tissue overall can control what gets through it. Only certain types of things can get through it that way. Oh, 30, this is one of these typical summary slides at the end. So this is stuff I've already talked about, but you might want to look at it when you study. I'm not going to read it to you, though. That means this chapter is done.